Deutsche Welle Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, William Ruto and Uhuru Kenyatta, the two Kenyan presidential hopefuls facing criminal charges at the ICC, are to run on the same ticket.
If the deal goes through and they're both elected, one will be the president, another will be the vice president. But then they'll have to spend a lot of time going to The Hague for the mentioning of their cases and so on and so forth. So really it's going to pose a big legal challenge.
And as M23 rebels in the DRC say they will carry on fighting, we hear from this analyst who says Africa should seek to resolve the conflict itself.
Our hope really is in the regional leaders, the International Conference for the Great Lakes Region, SADC and the East African community to put pressure for political will by Congo and the Rwanda, Uganda to stabilize the situation.
Those stories and more coming up in the next 25 minutes. Stay with us.
Top story.
Two prominent Kenyan politicians who are both due to go on trial at the International Criminal Court in The Hague have decided they will run for the Kenyan presidency in March of next year on a joint ticket. William Ruto and Uhuru Kenyatta, son of the country's founding father Jomo Kenyatta, face criminal charges in connection with the violence that marred the last elections in 2007 and 2008. I asked our Nairobi correspondent James Shimanyula what the two politicians had agreed amongst themselves.
The most interesting aspect out of the two politicians you have mentioned is that they have agreed to team up or to form a union so that they will be fielding one presidential candidate and the other will be a running mate. William Ruto will be running mate. In other words, he'll be going for the vice presidency. Uhuru Kenyatta will be going for the big job that is the president of this country. And that is the deal that has been sealed and which is being loosely referred to as a historic political marriage.
How much support do the two have and where does that support come from?
The support that the two candidates have comes from two very important voting areas in Kenya. One is Rift Valley region, where William Ruto is the strong person from there. Two is Central Kenya, which is Uhuru Kenyatta's stronghold. For our listeners, Central Kenya is home to Kenya's largest ethnic group, the Kikuyu, while Rift Valley region is home to the Kalenjin, the third placed largest ethnic group in Kenya, where William Ruto comes from. And I can assure you, Mark, that the votes in Rift Valley are more than one would have expected even to be challenged by anybody. In other words, the two areas are the strongest in Kenya. Once you have them, you'll see yourself becoming a president of this country.
How have their rivals been reacting to their alliance?
Their rivals are keeping their heads down, trying to wait and see if some of them may join others in this political bandwagon that is, I can characterize as unpredictable and dramatic. You know very well that Raila Odinga, the Prime Minister of Kenya, and Musalia Mudavadi, the Deputy Prime Minister, and Vice President Kalonzo Musyoka, are also fighting on their own. None of them has shown any sign of joining the other. So it's just a drama that is yet to unfold.
What are ordinary Kenyans making of this latest development?
Kenyans, ordinary people, are wondering. Because, Mark, here we are seeing a clear case of what we call tribal bloc coming together. In other words, instead of people uniting as one front or maybe two fronts just to go to the elections, to be elected by people belonging to Kenya's 42 ethnic groups. We are seeing two front runners, the ones we have mentioned, William Ruto and Uhuru Kenyatta, showing not only ordinary Kenyans, but the international community that with our large tribe, the Kikuyu, and another big tribe, the Kalenjin, we can make it. It's a tribal arithmetic that is surprising everybody. Instead of going by what the ordinary people say, they wish people would have united.
James Shimanyula, clearly this is not just a big domestic story in Kenya. The rest of the world will be watching as well. After all, it involves two suspects at a trial at the International Criminal Court, which is expected to start in 6 months' time. Should this not have barred them, morally at least, from seeking high office? I put that question to Brian Singero-Wanyama, political scientist at Kenya's Muliro University.
According to Madam Bensouda of the ICC, she indicated clearly that the ICC timetable is not tied to the Kenyan election process. In effect, it means whether they are elected to the office or not, the ICC process will definitely go on.
So, in other words, the status of one of them as president would have no legal implications whatsoever as far as the ICC is concerned?
Well, that is something really to point about, because the truth of the matter is one of them is going for the presidential position, namely Uhuru Kenyatta, with William Ruto as his running mate. In effect, it implies that if the deal goes through and they're both elected, one will be the president, another will be the vice president. But then they'll have to spend a lot of time going to The Hague for the mentioning of their cases and so on and so forth. So really it's going to pose a big legal challenge.
The two have been lobbying in other African countries for their case to be heard in Kenya rather than in The Hague. How have Kenya's neighbours been reacting to this lobbying?
We're witnessing a scenario where the neighbouring countries, especially those where Uhuru Kenyatta has visited to solicit for support regarding the transfer of the ICC case to Kenya, where I think they're just in a state of... They really don't know what to say, because he's a neighbor and there he is coming for help. I do not know whether they have made any firm commitments, because we have not heard about the kind of any firm commitments from any one of them. But as a brother, as a neighbor, definitely they have emotional feelings about the cases coming to Kenya.
Why were they so keen for the case to be heard in Kenya rather than in The Hague?
That really boggles everyone's mind. But I think the general feeling is that if the cases are heard in Kenya, perhaps there'll be more fairness to them as it is. But in my view, I do not really see so much of a difference, especially if we'll have the judiciary being independent as it has proven to be. So in my view, and in my understanding, their wishes, their feeling that the cases should be heard in Kenya, perhaps according to them, they feel they'll be heard better, the judges will be fair, judges have a better understanding of issues that took place in Kenya.
How much damage has been done to Kenya's reputation internationally?
The events that took place after the 2007 elections really was a black dot to Kenya's reputation. The ICC cases have depicted us not in a very bright manner, especially among the peers in the world.
Brian Singero Wanyama.
Africa Link, bringing you the story behind the story.
Zambia says it is on high alert for an influx of refugees fleeing the fighting in the neighbouring Democratic Republic of Congo. A Zambian government minister said they were working closely with the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, to avert a crisis. Yondamko Sako works for the office of the UNHCR's representative in Lusaka. I asked him how many refugees from the DRC had fled to Zambia since the fighting had re-erupted.
Since the situation escalated in the North Kivu, as of today, we hosted 731 refugees in Zambia. Congolese coming not only from the Kivus, but also some of them from the Katanga, North Katanga.
What have they been telling you and your staff about their experiences?
I must say that, as you know, this falls under the assessment linked to the asylum procedures, which is directly led by the government in Zambia and the structure that they set in place to do this. So for the time, the assessment is ongoing, and I think that it is a process, and soon we'll be able, in an objective manner, had a feedback out from this assessment.
Do you expect the number of refugees entering Zambia from the DRC to grow rapidly?
The trend so far indicates that when they came within a period of 2 weeks to 1 month, they are going back. Let me give two examples. The first influx was between end of October and beginning of November, where 123 Congolese crossed the border. Then before the end of November, as of now, just remain 61 out of the 123 who crossed the border. Last week, again, it was reported from the authorities, from the Commission of Refugees, that 500 new arrivals, in addition to the 61 before, crossed the border due to some fighting between the Mai Mai and the National Army Force of DRC in the North Katanga. So on Monday, meaning yesterday, the figures were confirmed. 100 out of the 500 who came during the weekend again returned back. So at the time where we are speaking, it remained only 400 in addition to the 61 that came in October. So in total, we have 461 new arrivals in Wapula province.
Yondamko Sako from the UNHCR in Zambia. We stay with the conflict in the DRC. Jean-Marie Runiga, the political leader of the M23 rebels, says his group will not leave Goma and is ready to fight the DRC army, thereby defying a Monday deadline imposed by a Great Lakes region conference at the weekend. For analysis of this conflict, I turn to Jaki Siliers, director of South Africa's Institute for Security Studies. My first question was, how much of a threat is the rebel occupation of Goma to security in the region?
The Eastern DRC remains hugely volatile. It's a vacuum into which neighbouring armies and rebel groups enter at will, and where the Congolese government exercises absolutely no authority. And while this is the situation, the region remains unstable, and it destabilizes, therefore, the entire region, a huge problem for Africa.
The United States senior envoy for Africa, Johnny Carson, has been shuttling between capitals in the Great Lakes region. How significant is this diplomatic activity?
The challenge that we have is that we have a UN mission in the DRC, 17,000 troops, one of the largest, if not the largest in the world, has not succeeded over several years and several billion dollars in stabilizing the DRC. And I'm not sure that Johnny Carson, that the United States, or indeed the UN Security Council, can muster the resources to make a significant difference on the ground. Our hope really is in the regional leaders, the International Conference for the Great Lakes region, SADC, and the East African community to pressure for political will by Congo and the Rwanda, Uganda, to stabilize the situation, to create a conducive environment that will allow normality and governance and stability to emerge.
What is the intensity of Rwandan involvement in this conflict? Are the M23 rebels taking orders from Kigali?
Well, every indication is that that is indeed the case. We've had SADC come out condemning them. We've had various UN reports do that. Nobody can really put a smoking gun, can really finger a smoking gun, but it does appear as if the circumstantial evidence is simply impossible to ignore. So we are all concerned. Of course, the challenge for Kigali is that the region is unstable and it serves as a source of instability into the very small Rwanda. So there are understandable reasons, but at the end of the day, it is important that we respect the borders, that there is a degree of inviolability on the colonially inherited borders in the region.
What objectives is Rwanda pursuing?
One can only summarize conjecture, and it does seem twofold. On the one side, Rwanda seems to argue that it requires strategic depth to ensure its own security, given the instability along its own borders and the very small size and huge population density of Rwanda.
The DRC is a huge place. Is it in danger of breaking up?
The DRC is vacuous, and there is no central source of authority over the country. And as you know, it's a massive country. Africa is very concerned about the importance of not allowing countries to splinter, because it has a knock-on effect. Whether the DRC is indeed governable over time, we will see.
Jaco Cilliers, Director of South Africa's Institute for Security Studies.
Africa on the Move.
Many people in Nigeria rely on generators for electricity, both for their businesses and at home. Many use Chinese-made generators, which have high carbon emissions. Such emissions are not just bad for the environment in the form of carbon monoxide, they can also be lethal. Whole families have been killed by this form of accidental poisoning. In this week's Africa on the Move, four schoolgirls say they've found an ingenious solution, which not only saves lives, but also, in a small way, helps the planet as well. From Lagos, Sam Olukoya reports.
The teenagers from the Doregos Private Academic School in Lagos say they created the urine-powered generator in order to save lives following several deaths resulting from the use of fuel-powered generators. Eniola Bello is one of the four students who created the generator.
Many Nigerians have died because of carbon monoxide poisoning from our carbon-based generators. So we decided to make a device that won't produce poisonous substances such as carbon monoxide, and many Nigerians won't have to lose their lives.
The generator has yet another environmental benefit in a country like Nigeria, where people pass urine in open places because there are very few public toilets. Another member of the student team, Adebola Duro Aino, explains.
When Nigerians know that they can power a generator by urine, definitely they won't litter everywhere with urine or pollute the environment with urine.
The girls carry out routine checks on the generator as they prepare to power it. It is powered with gas formed from urine stored in a sealed compartment attached to the generator. Urine rather than wastewater is used because it has more hydrogen. The students put metals inside the urine to help it form the hydrogen used to power the generator. Duro Aino told me how it works.
Oh, we have 6 liters of urine inside this compartment, and it can power our generator for 36 hours. This urine is being electrolyzed, releasing hydrogen and oxygen gas. And then this goes into our gas tank. Our gas tank here stores in the gas. And anytime we need the gas, we can open up the gas tank and release the gas. And our generator is powered on.
And now it is time to power the generator. The bulbs in the room shine brightly as the generator comes alive.
Wow. So that's the generator working now?
Yes, the generator powers everything in the house.
And we can see the very bright light. So the first day you had light, how was the excitement? That first day there was light.
Very excited. We're right outside the school compound. We're so excited. We're like so happy once the generator.
So it's not like in the Bible when they said, let there be light.
Light.
The invention of the urine-powered generator comes at a time of growing public pressure on the Nigerian government to urgently address the country's electricity problems.
Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
Making a difference.
In Zimbabwe, 7 years ago, the government ordered a massive slum clearing operation, which provoked widespread condemnation, not least because it made hundreds of thousands of people homeless. Some are still without a roof over their heads to this day. For a group of young people who went through the trauma of eviction, football is now helping them to rebuild their lives. Columbus Mafunga reports from the outskirts of Harare on how sport is making a difference.
I'm visiting one of the places where people were left homeless in 2005 when the Zimbabwean government demolished what used to be their homes. Operation Muramba Tswina, or Drive Out Filth, as President Robert Mugabe's government called it, was meant to flush out criminal elements. But the result of the operation, according to the UN, is that it left about 900,000 Zimbabweans homeless in a cold winter. Now the organization Zimbabwe Youth Achievement Sports for Development is trying to improve the lives of some youths left without a roof over their heads. Farai Mweta is an official with the organization.
Most of these guys are affected during that year because some of them, they skipped their like Form 1, Form 2, Form 3 because of the challenges that we were facing.
Mweta said so far a 19-year-old young boy among the homeless youths has shown great potential. He will be playing for a Zimbabwe top team, Black Rhinos Football Club, when the new season begins next year.
I think I place is like I want to play like a Pentano, so like many players out Zimbabwe, especially South Africa.
20-year-old Tinashe Manjeso is another homeless footballer, and he told me why he's part of the Zimbabwe Youth Achievement Sports for Development.
In our community, there are a lot of crimes committed, so soccer keeps us occupied. Idle youth turn to drug abuse, but soccer reduces that. There are many unemployed youths in Zimbabwe, but through soccer we are occupied and reduce incidents that might result in us getting the HIV virus.
Farai Mweta of the Zimbabwe Youth Achievement Sports for Development said his organization was looking further than just turning homeless youths into soccer players.
We want to see these people being one of a prominent people within the society, to the role models, you know, might be in football. So we want to see people where the people then say they can have testimony. So people, they know that, no, if you're in a difficult situation, it doesn't mean that the life is over for you, but there is an opportunity. You need to just persevere.
The Zimbabwe Youth Achievement for Sports Development is making a difference to the lives of many young people in this part of Harare. But it remains to be seen if the organization will expand its activities to help all youths in the country who were left homeless by the government.
Columbus Mafunga reporting from Zimbabwe. A reminder of our main stories. The two Kenyan presidential candidates facing charges at the International Criminal Court are to run for election on a joint ticket. Zambia says it is on high alert for refugees fleeing the fighting in the Democratic Republic of Congo. We've also been hearing how urine is being used as a source of hydrogen for power generation in Nigeria, and how football is helping homeless young people in Zimbabwe. And there we come to the end of this edition of Africa Link. Remember, we're always interested in your thoughts on this programme. You can send an email to feedback.africa@dw.de or a letter to our postal address, Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. Africa Link will be back again at the same time tomorrow. Do join us if you can. This is Mark Caldwell in Bonn.